Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Today's conversation was sparked by a confronting question. What happens when environmental toxins quietly alter biology across generations, and why aren't we talking about it more? My guest today is Matt Landos, veterinarian and director of Future Fisheries Veterinary Service. In this episode, we're exploring how early environments, access to education, and lived experience shapes values that last a lifetime. Matt's work reveals how what we put into our landscapes ultimately shapes our waterways, our food systems, and our bodies. Hello, Matt. I'm so grateful that you've joined me. I'd love to understand what kind of childhood environment allowed your passion for animals, science, and the natural world to flourish.
I had, you'd have to say, quite a privileged childhood. Whilst fairly humble in a public house, growing up in public housing in Canberra, my father worked in the public service, as you do in Canberra, starting as a clerk, but he did work his way up through the ranks with time to work in quarantine and inspection service, the Australian AQUIS service. It was probably there that some of my interest and interactions with veterinarians began, around animal health and management of animal health. My mother was a nurse and a tremendously caring person, which I think all nurses just innately are. So this was the crucible I grew up in. I have an older brother and younger sister. So some sibling rivalry was always alive. I was fortunate to have a good pathway of education through into university. So this is a pretty privileged run at life to have those kind of opportunities in front of you. So I like to try and make the most of those things. So I spend quite a portion of my time these days doing things that make no money. Or as I like to say, I have a client in my business and they're called the environment. They're just a rubbish client though, because they don't pay their bills. But they're a client who I can't help but keep working for, because they're the biggest piece of our future.
Exactly. And I've often wondered, and this is probably the perfect question for you, why people are so disconnected from an environment and the ecosystems that operate within it that provide everything on the planet life.
Well, it's an interesting one. I think there's many drivers that draw us away from these connections in our lives now. A part of it, I think, has been the way in which the consumer economy drives us to be individualistic rather than community focused. So it tells us all we need a lawnmower. Everyone must have a leaf blower. We don't need to borrow one from our neighbours. Why do that? You can have your own. And this striving that is within us, I think, biologically, to want things and to compete, has been harnessed by the market economy. It's been unbelievably successful in driving individualism as a way of thinking. And it is now, I think, the all-pervasive mode of thinking. We see it difficult now, under normal circumstances, to pull communities together. Even in cities, people feel like they're relatively alone. We have an epidemic of loneliness, remarkably, at the highest population level there's ever been on the planet. You wouldn't think that those two statistics could sit next to each other, but they do. And we also have these drivers. So the way in which the market economy is able to reach us through our devices and through the internet has been an accelerant to be able to drive individualism and drive attention away from each other and also away from the environment. If you can comfortably curl up in your lounge, probably made of synthetic fibres, care of the fossil fuel industry, watching Netflix, feeling amused enough, having your meal brought in by some drivers probably immigrants who've come to the country on low pay, and this can suffice now as a life without a need to drive a deeper interaction with the environment or exist within the ecology. Within the colonial headspace, the value system which emerged was one of dominance over nature, was over the right of man, and particularly it was gendered. It was man over everything, over woman, over everything, over all animal, tree, plant, water. We were there to dominate it. Now, this isn't hidden from view. This is written as a construct within Christianity. So religion plays a role in here, because if you attend to the reading of Genesis, you'll see all of what has been put on earth is put there for you to exploit, you to use, not you to be a part of. There are other ways of conceiving of how humans live within an ecology or on the earth, but mostly colonialists, so our civilization is a colonial one here in Australia, is one that has disconnected from what were Indigenous perspectives on how they live. They wouldn't say, it's my river. They'd say things like, the river is in us. They're a part of it. They're a part of the country. The whole concept of ownership is very, very different if you change the lens of the value system. But through adopting this this value system of colonialism, we've created unfortunately, a self-fulfilling prophecy of collapse, because we exploit the environment. We don't have a handbrake.
We can see this playing out in real time right now. I mean, especially with what's happening globally and how we're seeing powers just stepping in and taking over at every vantage point. It's just chaotic. How do you think we can instill those values that you were just espousing for being part of something and not dominating it in our children moving forward to reverse some of this?
Well, I think some really useful initiatives are teaching in the environment. So my son's school has commenced a little bit of taking the students out of the classroom, taking them out into a nature setting and saying, well, what can we learn here? What shaped these landforms? What forces were at play? What history can we learn in this area? How would we know? What can we look at? So this strikes up into powers of observation. It starts bringing up the questions of, well, why is that plant living there but not living down there on that sand dune? What's different? So these types of programs, I think, can be very powerful in shifting the way children think. I think disconnecting them from devices is tremendously important. As much as possible, no devices. I'm perhaps a bit of an oddball. I don't think AI is going to be a solution to anything. I think it's going to be an unmitigated disaster, because whilst there may be these small benefits that everyone can conceive of efficiency, that this is somehow going to take us somewhere better, faster, nobody's addressed the direction. So we're going in the wrong direction. So we're going in the wrong direction faster. That seems like a really tremendously bad idea. I personally try and minimize time on devices and encourage my son to do outdoor activities with others. So not in isolation, trying to facilitate opportunities to go out and go camping, go fossicking for some fancy colored crystals, just go spend time in nature and slow down and enjoy nature. It creates a different experience and a different lot of values. Talking across generations, I think, is also really important. I'm fortunate. I have a few good friends who come around every so often and we play guitars together. I'm not a talented guitarist. I'm terrible, but I enjoy the company. And having a group of men in a room playing guitars around my son has a wonderful effect. It's like having a whole lot of uncles that he doesn't have biologically, but each of them interact with him. And this offers a wonderful cross-generational experience that I think, again, is it helps shape people. It helps give them the opportunity to try and talk, to put things in their own words. And when you've got compassionate and empathetic people around, this is a wonderful thing. I've got a lovely partner who has boundless empathy, and she works in the welfare sector. So she's this morning out helping in a homelessness service around town here in Ballina. Now, she now knows all of the homeless people by first name here in Ballina. They all know my son. They interact in the street. They interact as friends, not as that person over there or that junkie or some other derogatory put down. The humanity of people is able to be seen if you experience it. So being able to experience that humanity changes how we view people. If you scream at them down an internet portal or some sort of social media rant, you're not experiencing humanity. You're divorced from it. And unfortunately, I think this is where many people spend vast amounts of time, which is not profitable for them, not profitable for their communities, and not profitable for our children who are desperately needing guidance and support, opportunities to interact so that they can help see ways forward. They can help construct pathways to help us out of the mess that we have created.
People seem to be so disenfranchised and angry, you know, the keyboard warriors you were just talking about on social media, they are removed. What direction should we be taking in relation to trying to reconnect people? Because it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, where people, they're not connected to nature, but they're also not connected to their food, and therefore they're not interested in what's in it and how it may affect them long term.
I think regionally things are slightly easier here in that we have, in some areas, I'm fortunate here in the North Coast to have multiple farmers markets that have developed, which are an initiative that brings people into a common place. It's back to the marketplace. It's not just a place to pick up your veggies. It's a place that you will run into your neighbours. You will get the opportunity to say, how are you doing? Gee, it's been wet. Talk about the weather. Or anything else that happens to come onto your mind. But these are a social initiative. So things like farmers markets are very, very helpful in bringing people together. But I think we need to go significantly further. And some communities, I think, are recognising this, usually after they've been struck by disaster. So up the river from me here is the town of Lismore, which was absolutely decimated in floods in 2022. This had a tremendous impact on the psychology of the community at a community level. They realised that the government wasn't coming to save them. This crisis drove a whole behaviour change in that community. It was already a pretty rich community and diverse, but people recognised that they had more in common than their differences, and that this became a tremendously important thing moving forward to be resilient. And this is progressing in many small areas with smaller groups of people. I don't think it can happen necessarily at scale. I think it requires a community level. This might be 50 or 100 people getting together, 150 people, but probably not 5,000. A smaller group where people can know each other, they can begin to come up with what is effectively their own governance systems. They can recognise that the governance we have, well, is it driving us in the right direction? If we are supporting an agricultural industry which is causing harm to our children and harm to us via the food and via the environmental impacts, is this what we want our community members to be doing? Is this where we'd like our food to come from? So you can start positing different questions, and within that construct of a whole new citizens' governance structure, you can begin to conceive of other ways to do things. And out of this is rising things like the regenerative food movement, where people are recognising that there are some alternative ways to do things. They are very different. We have to do money differently. We can't think of profit just within the fence boundary, because there are externalities that move outside of the fence. Who's going to pay for those? Or if we'd like the food to be done differently, how do we support the viability of the farmer if they're not going to be given access to the chemistry which they in many cases, would say is necessary in the current climate for them to be economic. So this is a important change in thinking. I think it's beginning, the seeds of it sprinkling around all over the place as people recognise that the government's interests have departed from public interest.
Matt, what was the catalyst for you to dive deeper into chemical impacts on reproduction?
I was a fairly traditional veterinarian early on, working in a mixed practice, cats and dogs and every other animal. And I did have a keen interest always in aquatic life. And some years later, came back to fish and as an area of special interest. And since around 2000, I've worked exclusively with aquatic animals. And I had a particular case up around the Noosa hinterland area, which really forever changed my trajectory of thinking. That was a case involving a fish hatchery that was breeding native species for restocking into reservoirs and places like that for recreational anglers and for conservation. It was a fairly small little hatchery, but it was immediately surrounded on three sides by a commercial macadamia production farm. And the tree nut farm had been operating as an organic enterprise for many years, but it changed ownership and it went over to become a commercial, conventionally run operation, which involved a pattern of use of different pesticide sprays to try and control pests and diseases in the crop and improve the yield of the crop. Now, coincidental with that timing, the fish hatchery performance collapsed with mass mortalities and a lot of deformities developing in early embryo development. Now, fish are quite interesting because you can actually watch the embryo develop. It happens outside of the fish's body because they spawn their eggs into the water. So we can collect them and put them under the microscope and actually observe the cells as they organise themselves into an embryo. So just dividing initially from the two cells to the four to the eight and then beginning to organise, where some are becoming eyes and some are going to become the tail and someone's got to be the liver. So everyone gets a message about where to go and what to be. Through the course of that case and then for the subsequent that was 2009, so we're quite a few years on, it's become very clear that a whole lot of things can impact the development of embryos. So that was really my light globe moment, that things which were registered for use, so approved as chemicals for use in agriculture, improved, being used in the way they were intended. So there's label instructions on chemicals and they say how much to put on and how to spray it. And under that use guidance, we're told that these products will be safe. My interpretation of safe at the time was, well, nothing will be harmed. These will be safe. But my fish were telling me a very, very different story, because they were dying, becoming deformed, and survival went effectively down to zero. This was very concerning. So this was really like a little microcosm looking at fish in tanks on a very small fish hatchery. But the thought occurred to me, what's happening in our rivers? Because some of our native fish species are certainly in precipitous decline. Could it be that there is impacts happening in our rivers also, on this very early life stage, embryonic life stage? So this set me off on a course of an awful lot of reading. Now, I'm a torrid reader. I don't read fiction. I don't have time. I dedicate all my time to reading science papers. I try and explain to my son that it's good to be a nerd. Being a nerd means you read a lot. So I've read an awful lot. What it's taught me is that there is a huge body of science around very low doses of chemicals impacting embryonic development. And being a veterinarian, this is a pretty unique discipline that allows you to see that there is a relationship in an evolutionary perspective across all animals, including people. People are just another animal to me because I'm a veterinarian and I see the correlations, the evolutionary conservation of our systems of operation. So these are things like our hormone system. People would be familiar with testosterone and estrogen as the male and female sex hormones. They might be less familiar to understand that we both actually have both of those hormones. Males and females have some testosterone and estrogen, and they play very critical roles in development. But there are many other hormones that also control our bodies, things like thyroid hormone and insulin. People might have heard of those in relation to diabetes or thyroid disease. Now, when you zoom out a little bit from my microcosm of fish, you begin to see there's an awfully large, much bigger problem, which is that human health is in significant decline. So rates of disease associated with these hormone substances are going up year on year on year, and they're causing critical problems at things like infertility. It used to be tremendously easy to have kids, so much so that scientists came up with contraception, the pill, because it was just too easy to get pregnant. Now that has all changed. One in six couples now need fertility treatment, one in six. It's going up every year. Sperm count is going down in men. It's dropping nearly 2% a year. These are dramatic declines. In women, miscarriage rates are going up. We're up to around one in three pregnancies now miscarry. And this is part of the hidden numbers, which we don't discuss at a public level. Miscarriage is a tremendously traumatic event in anybody's life, but we don't record that data very studiously. We do record when a woman first has a child, though, but we don't note whether she had three, four, five, or even seven miscarriages before she managed to hang on to her pregnancy through to term. We know that even going to term is something that's declining. Preterm births are going up all the time. Cancers are going up. So these questions started circling around in my mind. Why so? This is the scientist within, always asking the question, why?
Love it. And I think we need, as a society, to be questioning a whole lot more. In fact, I've spoken often on this program about curiosity and critical thinking. When we look at the existential threats that exist to human life, how do we start addressing climate change and chemical disruption so that we do have a future on this planet?
So the climate change, I think, is very intimately linked with how we manage water. It's perhaps a much smaller piece of the discussion than people are used to hearing, where the dominant narrative is around carbon dioxide, which is important. It's not a part of it. It is a part of climate change. But from my assessment of things, I think it's not the biggest part. The biggest part is water and how we manage water on landscapes. So people will be familiar, if they spray their body in water and then stand in the wind, they feel cold. Evaporation is a cooling process. Now, water vapor is a tremendous coolant. Plants, if you put plants around your house and they're transpiring water out of their leaves, your air will be cooler. Your house will be cooler. The sun is still just as hot as it ever was, but plants allow cooling. So if we take a look at what we've done to our landscape and the plants on our landscape, you'll see that over vast areas, we've removed them completely. We spray them out until we have bare earth, and then we might plant a crop, usually a monoculture. It's temporary. We cut it down. We might be growing wheat or canola or barley, and then we start again. Now, that soil is drying out and dying under our current method of farming. So the carbon level in the soil goes down, which it has been, and we see the soil biology collapsing. And so the soil itself collapses. It becomes compacted. This stops the rain penetrating. So the rain should go in much more so than it does, but now it goes off. It runs off. So a vast increase in water runoff is occurring rather than going into our soil. So we have this problem of landscape dehydration at a planetary scale. This is where we're not recharging groundwater at anywhere near the rate that we're extracting it. The consequence is that the water, which should be in the land, is now in the air and in the sea. Now, people are seeing this. So seeing golf ball-sized hail used to be something that was as rare as rocking horse shit. Now we're seeing golf ball sized hail all the time. Everyone gets a go at golf ball sized hail now because the amount of moisture in the air has risen, because we've dehydrated our landscape. We've accelerated this by cutting drains into every wetland that ever existed in Australia. We've drained the whole lot. That water runs away. It only has two places to go. It can't go away. It goes to the sea and sea level rises. People are familiar with the idea that glaciers melting might cause sea level rise, but most people don't talk about the fact we've dehydrated the landscape to the tune of millions of gigalitres of water is not on the land. These are part of the climate impacts. What we see on dry soil, if we get one of those pizza temperature guns where you can point the gun at the pizza oven and say, is it hot enough to whack my pizza in yet? If you point one of those at a bare earth paddock in an Australian summer, what you get is about 60 degrees C. So pretty bloody hot soil. If you point it at a vegetated paddock, so one that just has multi-species grasses, in the same thermal conditions, same time of day, it'll be about 25 degrees. That creates a massive mass of hot air. That hot air changes rainfall. So the moist, cool air that normally comes in from the coast can't get in because there's a massive heat dome created over the top of the landscapes which we've created. The good news is that this is reversible. These are the solutions. There are people who I think have had incredible foresight, people like Peter Andrews, who was working up in the Hunter Valley, looking at slowing water down on his landscape, rehydrating a landscape. His son, Stuart, is now doing tremendous work across a huge array of landscapes, from the Channel Country in Queensland to other drainage in Victoria and even East Coast drainage. This isn't an if or maybe this will work. It works. It absolutely works. And it's, in fact, how our landscape worked before we messed with it. So we can increase rainfall. We can increase water storage in the ground. We can decrease air temperature. We can increase productivity off our landscapes. We can certainly improve water quality in our rivers, which are now tremendously damaged as a result of the way the water moves. In the Richmond River here, where I live in northern New South Wales, we're somewhere down, bubbling along less than 5% of the long-term productivity. We used to farm 1 million oysters a year. Now we farm zero from this one river. We used to have 33 families full-time employed fishing the river. We've now got two blokes who are both part-time and have off-river work just to be viable economically. They didn't catch them all. The food web doesn't work to create them anymore. It's a combination of this runoff containing too much sediment. It's got too much chemical in it because we spray our landscapes with pesticides. These are chemicals that, by design, kill life. They're biocides. That is what they're designed to do. They don't stay where they're put. So when we look, like in my local river, one of my colleagues sampled some oysters here, published the work in a peer-reviewed journal. At no time did we find less than 8 pesticides in the oysters over 2 years. Every time we looked, 21 different chemicals in total were identified. We'd like to think it stays put where we put it, but it doesn't. It goes into the water and it keeps causing biological impacts, just as it did to those poor little fish embryos that I was first looking at down the microscope in Noosa. And it's doing it to us as well. Our children are changing. Their anatomy is changing. People will say that kids are behaving differently. And they are. They absolutely are behaving differently. Things like attention deficit disorder has gone through the roof, particularly in boys. But you notice some interesting things. People say, oh, it's bad parenting. Too much screen time. The screen time has made the kid turn into an attention deficit child. Now, those things might not help. But let me tell you something that has nothing to do with those. So boys, when they develop a penis, normally they pee at the very tip of their penis. That's where their urethra, the urinary tract, exits, at the very tip of their penis. That's normal anatomy. Now, there's a condition in boys where the urinary tract exits at the base of the penis or halfway down the shaft of the penis. This condition's called hypospadias, is the medical term. The rate of that condition in boys is going up 1% a year. 1% a year rise. Now, I'm pretty sure that bad parenting can't change the development of the urethra, nor can watching the screen move your anatomy around like that. But we do know the toxic chemistry in the womb and exposing the parents prior to conception can certainly make these changes. So we're changing the anatomy of our children, not just their genitalia, but also their brains. And of course, this is the major driver for why neurological behavior of children is changing, because the way we develop a brain is changed. So it's ever so important that we clean up our food and fiber. We do that by addressing the hydrological cycle. So food and fiber is where it starts for me, because that's where we have the greatest ability to impact water. We move to systems that do food and fiber without the toxicants. So without the pesticides, we need to invest in techniques to achieve this. We have some of the pieces. I don't believe we have all of them. We're not investing deeply in doing so. We're going the other way, actually. We're investing in adding more chemicals to our food, not less. It's extraordinarily counterintuitive if you understand and read. This stuff, for some people, might sound like a sort of a hippie conspiracy about chemicals, but they just need to go to the peak body for endocrinologists. These are the specialists, medical specialists who work on hormones. They've written scientific statements and they say, massive problem, huge amount of evidence, every year more evidence, more certainty. It's definitely a problem. We definitely need to reduce exposure. And that means cleaning up food, but it means cleaning up the entire consumer economy. Plastics are a huge issue in this piece.
Matt Landos, honestly, I could talk to you all day, and I think we're going to have to revisit this conversation because we haven't even touched on half of all these questions I have now out of our initial discussion. Thank you so much for your time, and I look forward to you joining me again.
Thanks very much for the chance to chat, Kim.
Veterinarian Matt Landos, quietly raising our awareness of what's integral to life. Awareness of inequity, awareness of environment, and awareness that land, water, animals, and humans are inseparable. When we teach our children to value the environments they grow up in, creeks, wetlands, farms, rivers, we're not just teaching ecology, we're teaching stewardship, responsibility, and intergenerational care. The legacy we leave is written not only in words, but in landscapes and ecosystems. And the question we're left with is simple. What environments are we creating for children to grow into leaders who care? That's it for another week. Thanks for joining me. Don't forget, next week, we've got another guest who's going to talk about the influences that help us become the people we're meant to be. Mark Rowland is the Chief Collaboration Officer with Rocketeer, and his story will amaze and inspire you to think about what your children might become.